香歌，我就拜了香歌，哦你我罗，耶里家家，哦你小歌，耶如马勒，香歌。
People use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Thank you. good evening, radio audience. I am your host, William Rogers, and I welcome all of you this evening to the Black Reality Think Tank. As you know, we are here every Tuesday evening from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And it is a pleasure and an honor for me to join with you today and to share some thoughts. We are talking today about just break the damn lock. Just break the damn lock, and you can do it. As it relates to mental slavery, we hear so much about the discussion of freeing the African mind and breaking the vice locks that are on the brain. And we want to talk about that, and we want to come up with we have a program and an idea, have a wonderful guest that's going to come on and talk about some things that she is doing out in the Dallas, Texas area, working with children and breaking the lock. And so it's wonderful to have her. She'll join us very soon. But again, I'm always appreciative of all of you. The Black Reality Think Tank is a sponsor of the Motherland Media Network that also has a program on this system as well. We are operating on the radio platform of timeforanawakening.com, timeforanawakening.com, which is a part of the broadcast structure of blacktalkradionetwork.com. And so it's an honor for the Black Reality Think Tank to join this wonderful family of radio programs that air all during the week. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of those programs and the times that they come on as we progress on into the program. So we have, as I've said, we've lined up a very good discussion and talking about the whole idea of education and how to control that and breaking the chains on our minds and doing some of those things that we hear so much about. And a lot of times over the months and the weeks that we've been talking about this subject, a lot of folks will say, well, what's the solution? How are we going to do that? And that's always an easy question to ask, but a very difficult one to answer. And so we are going to attempt today to offer a solution element. And it's not total solution, but it is definitely a contribution to the solution process. And as I said, we have a wonderful young lady that's going to come on and share some of her thoughts and things that she's doing in her community. The Black Reality Think Tank is a part of the Sankofa Historical Society, and we have been operating now for about a year. We are also on blogtalkradio.com. We air there on every Saturday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio. This Saturday, we will be broadcasting with a tribute to the great and powerful Malcolm X, whose birthday happens to be on Saturday. So we'll be doing a special broadcast in recognition of our wonderful brother, Malik El-Hajj Shabazz. And then we have a program also on Sunday that talks about the history of gospel music and how it has impacted the lives of African Americans. And I'll also talk about that very shortly as well. But the Sankofa Historical Network operates out of Washington, D.C. at Howard University. And so we are glad to be a part of that little team of folk and to be able to bring to you subjects relating to our historical existence. Is we must deal with our history. That's so necessary for us as part of any liberation movement. We must know who we are and where we've come from. And as John Henry Clark said in the beginning of the program, history is a clock that tells us our political, cultural time of day. So anyway, last week we had a dynamic and a wonderful conversation talking about the Kanye West incident, but we were using it as a format to talk about education and to talk about, you know, what our children know and should know and how they should understand, you know, our past. And obviously, we were using the Kanye West situation as a reflection of kind of the miseducation of the Negro based on that wonderful piece of literature by the great Carter G. Woodson. So we did a wonderful discussion. We had an intergenerational discussion. We had young people who were part of the Millennial Group, and they were here. We had a high school student. She wanted to share her opinion. And then also we had some elders who also had opinions about the issue. So a wonderful dialogue. And all of that is available in archival structure, which is simply go to the webpage of timeforanawakening.com, timeforanawakening.com. But all you need to do is go into www.timeforanawakening.com, www.timeforanawakening.com. And all of our programs are listed there, and all of our archival programs are there. And you can listen at any time 24/7 to any of the broadcasts that we do. So again, great opportunity to be here. Very pleased. Thank you all for joining us. It was a rainy day today in Georgia. You know, think about that song by Gladys Knight. You know, it's a rainy night in Georgia. And it does it does rain here a lot sometimes. But anyway, we've had a prior days. Yesterday, temperature was all the way up into about 96 degrees, 95. You know, so it was hot. And but it promises to warm up a little bit more later toward the end of the week. But anyway, thank all of you for joining us. One of the features that we do before we get into our conversation is we always like to honor our ancestors. I think that is so crucial. And we have a process that we do that we call the ancestral profile. And the ancestral profile obviously speaks to someone that has contributed very heavily to where we are and where we're to be. They, you know, we stand on the shoulders of great people, and so we must always cherish that and talk about them and speak their name into the universe because it's a part of it. So we do that, and we call it the ancestral profile. And today I'm honored to talk about an individual who has very clearly speaks right to the subject matter that we're dealing with. And she has been a landmark individual in terms of education. And her name is, I had to pull up a document here. Okay, and her name is, you know, it always happens when you're trying to find something. Lucy Laney Craft. Lucy Laney Craft. And Miss Craft was born April 13th, 1854. She transitioned to the ancestral realm on October the 24th, 1933. She was an early African-American educator who in 1883 founded the first school for black children in Augusta, Georgia. She was principal of the Haynes Institute for industrial and normal education for 50 years. Lucy Craft Laney was selected by the Governor Jimmy Carter, in 1974 to be one of the first African-Americans to have their portrait hung in the Georgia State Capitol. Lucy Craft was born, like I said, 11 years before the end of slavery and was outlawed at the end of the Civil War, supposedly. Lucy was the 17th of 10 children. She was the 7th of 10 children, born to Louisa and David Laney. Her parents were both former enslaved Africans, but her father had saved enough money to buy his freedom and that of his wife about 20 years before Lucy's birth. Both of her parents were strong believers in education and were very giving to strangers. This upbringing which strongly influenced Laney in her life. At the time of her birth, it was illegal for blacks to read. However, with the assistance of a woman by the name of Mrs. Camel, who was the owner of her sister, she learned to read at the age of 4. She attended Lewis, which became later Ballard High School in Macon, Georgia, which was a mission school run by the American Missionary Association. And in 1869, she entered the first class of Atlanta University, which later became Clark Atlanta University, where she prepared to be a teacher. She graduated from the school's teacher training program, which was called the Normal Department, in 1873. Laney worked as a teacher in Macon, Georgia, Mill Devige, Georgia, and Savannah, Georgia, for 10 years before deciding to open a school of her own. Due to health reasons, she settled in Augusta, Georgia, and founded the first school for black children. Her first class in 1983 was 6 children, but Laney attracted interest in the community, and by the end of the second year, the school had 234 students. With the increase in students, she needed more funding for her operation. She attended the Northern Presbyterian Church Convention, which was held in 1886 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and pleaded her case there, but was turned down initially. One of the attendees, Francine E. Haynes, later declared an interest and donated $10,000 to Laney for the school. And with this money, Laney expanded her offerings. She changed the school's name to the Haynes Normal and Industrial Institute in honor of her benefactor and to indicate its goals of industrial and teacher training. The school eventually grew to encompass an entire city block of buildings. And by 1928, the school's enrollment was more than 800 students. Laney also opened the first black kindergarten and the first black nursing home in Augusta, Georgia. She heavily influenced Mary McLeod Bethune, who was the founder of the Bethune-Cookman College in Daytona Beach, Florida. Bethune worked as a teacher briefly at her former elementary school in Sumter County. And in 1896, she began teaching at Haynes Normal and Industrial Institute in Augusta, Georgia, which was part, as I said before, the Presbyterian Mission, but was owned and operated by Lucy Craft Laney. As the daughter of former enslaved Africans, as I said, Laney ran her school with a Christian missionary zeal, emphasizing character and practical education for girls. She also accepted the boys, who showed up eagerly to learn. Laney's mission was to imbue Christian moral education in her students. Mary McLeod Bethune said she was so impressed with her fearlessness, her amazing touch in every respect and energy that seemed inexhaustible, and her mighty power to command respect and admiration from her students and all who knew her, she handed her domain with the art of a master. Bethune adopted many of Laney's education philosophies, including her emphasis on educating girls and women to improve the conditions of black people. She said, "I believe that the greatest hope for the development of my race lies in training our women thoroughly and practically. This is the strategy being followed by organizers now in numerous developing countries, educating women, raising the lives of families as a whole." After 1 year at Haynes, Bethune was transferred by the Presbyterian Mission to the Kendall Institute in South Carolina, where she had met and her current husband. We go on to talk that Lucy Craney left a daunting legacy for a lot of people to follow, and creating curriculums and special training programs and things like that. She did. As I said, she transitioned to the ancestral world on October 24, 1933. But very worthy, very, very, very worthy of further study. And so again, Lucy Craft Laney. Her last name is spelled L-A-N-E-Y. Okay. So with that, it gives us a good launching pad into our discussion today. And I think my guest is with me. I think I saw her come online. And I have a wonderful young lady who is out of Dallas, Texas, and has been doing some great work in education. I've had her on some of the other previous programs talk about some of the things that she's doing. She is a very powerful consultant to many public school systems in the area. She is a graduate of Clark Atlanta University, a dynamic young woman, and really a very, very good friend. And so at this time, I would like to introduce you to Miss Jamie Lachey. Good afternoon, good evening, Miss Lachey. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me. I know your schedule is busy, but I really appreciate you coming on. You know, anytime we try to talk about education and look at trying to build some new paradigms, I think that, you know, I can always count on you. So thank you so much for joining us. Today, I want to...
I appreciate you having me.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Today, I want to kind of talk about one of the promotional pamphlets or one of the promotional flyers that I did post about. I don't know if you had a chance to see it. Did you get a chance to see that information I sent?
No, actually. I don't know if you sent it on Facebook. You know, I'm not on there anymore.
Okay,
but,
okay. I got you. I did do that. But one of the things that I wanted to do today is I wanted to offer a solution. And you and I have talked about this under this program for a long time, and that is the idea of what we called Saturday schools. And the whole concept of Saturday schools obviously carries some very strong possibilities, you know, for change. But really, I mean, it doesn't have to. There are a lot of names for what that is. I mean, people have been doing this for a while. Obviously, we would not be the first one. It's just kind of, in a sense, reinstituting these schools and to getting them back going again. They once were available to us, but for some reason they didn't. Now, and they called them different things. They called them freedom schools. They called them Saturday schools. They called them community schools. And basically, the key factor for these schools is that they are not a part of the educational system. They are independent. They operate by the community, for the community, and in the community. And they are designed in the same way as a school does, but it's a lot more creative. We look at it from the sense that there is no paid staff. It's not an opportunity to for somebody to have an organization and write a grant and make a lot of money. The commitment is strictly bottom-line voluntary, and it's an attempt for someone who loves their community and loves their children to go in and begin to teach some of the ideas of culture and looking at some of the educational factors that are important for their growth and development. So the central piece here is culture. It's to play into that philosophy and idea that culture is clearly a part of the development of our children. And we're going to talk about that. So that's kind of distinct of what we're talking about and what we want to talk about and maybe what some of the other ideas were. There are other schools. There were, for instance, the Highland schools, I think, that had something to do with the different than there were the citizenship schools, the civil rights, the woman that Martin Luther King called the mother of the civil rights movement, Septima Clark, used to run a school called citizenship schools. And she was going into those rural southern places of Mississippi and Alabama, helping people to learn to read so that they could vote and be prepared to vote and helping them to understand the whole necessity of citizenship. That's different. That's a little different than what we're talking about tonight and what you and I have been talking about and what you are obviously beginning to do now in your program. So with that and having said that, before I begin, I want to play real quickly, Mr. Shea. I want to play a piece it's an interview that was done with Dr. Asa Hilliard and Naeem Akbar. As you know, Dr. Hilliard is an ancestor. Dr. Akbar is still around. But anyway, this is a very interesting discussion, and I want to play this for you and our listening audience to just kind of hear a little bit of what we are talking about when we are talking about setting up. And you and I plan to call them freedom schools, and you said you already have begun to name your program freedom schools. And so here's the whole idea of that and the philosophy that that type of system relays upon. So let's listen to Dr. Hilliard and Naeem Akbar in a in an interview that they did several years back. Okay, get it here in a minute. Okay, now we got it. Think I got it. Just bear with me a minute. Okay. It's coming. It's got a delay here. Just a second. Well. But Jamie, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Okay. Some reason it is not wanting to do. I'm going to still play it. I should have it here in a minute, Jamie. But the deal is, let's do this. How would you define culture? And while you're talking, I'm going to hope to try to get this this recording started. But how would you start off defining culture as it relates to African American education?
I think I'm going to steal from one of my spiritual teachers, and that's Dr. Amos Wilson.
Okay.
And he says, culture is a tool by which a group of people solve problems.
Okay, repeat that again. Say that first part again.
Oh, go ahead.
Repeat that.
Yes. So I'm saying Dr. Amos Wilson would say that culture is a tool by which a group of people solve problems for themselves.
Okay. Okay. I think we're getting some kind of interference in there. Go again. Go right ahead again. We're going to get this system together here a second. I just want you, if you could, just repeat that once more. Repeat that again for me.
Sure. So culture is basically a tool, a vehicle that a group of people use to solve problems for themselves. So all of the things that we use to unite ourselves, language, dance, food, all of these different things, they actually function as a gel that bring us together. But the bringing us together is for the function of solving problems.
Okay. Give me a little example of how that might work. Today, can you give me just kind of an example in terms of that? If someone said, "I'm gonna learn my culture more," so how does that definition relate into someone that would want to do that?
Well, what's interesting is I recently did a keynote for this group of teachers and educators and professionals in Boston, and I was talking to them about what is known as the white man's burden. Mm-hmm. And we broke that down as a culture as well. And we said, what problem does this culture solve? And so if anybody is unfamiliar with the white man's burden, it's this idea that comes out of the 1800s. It's this poem by this man. He talks about how white men are responsible for civilizing the world, saving the world by civilizing other people. And if you think about that in present day, that still exists through a lot of nonprofit work and education reform and all these different kind of movements where you have largely white-led, white male-led organizations and entities impacting and changing communities from which they have no real connection.
Okay.
Now, the culture there, the problem that they are solving there is how do we, as people who have, like, honestly pillaged and stolen and done harm to other groups of people around the world for generations, justify those actions. Mm-hmm. And so the culture that is built is one in which you profess yourself as a savior.
Mm-hmm.
Thus comes the white man's burden, you see. So you have a group of people who interact and behave in ways that solve a problem for themselves. In that case, the problem is, how do we articulate why this abuse and this theft and this endangerment of others is justifiable?
Mm-hmm.
Thus came the white man's burden. So that's the way that culture works, and that's just one example. But if I were to give another example with another group, and I were to talk about African-Americans, particularly post this enslavement process, a lot of the things that are cultural to us in this land has come through our survival,
mm-hmm.
Even down to the African-American spiritual. So when you think about spirituals in the Christian church, those songs were birthed out of a need, a necessity. Right. Those songs were used as tools to escape for freedom, to work in the fields. And so the things that we take for granted today, you might see in the church and people are singing and you have all of the soul that comes out of it. There's a history of that. That was a tool that was used by a group of people to solve a problem. At that time, it was their enslavement or their captivity.
Right.
So those are just a couple of examples of how culture works to solve problems.
Right. So in other words, if you were going to learn about life, just life, learn about life, you would have to mm-hmm. somehow or the other have a real good hold on your indigenous culture in order to do that.
Yes.
Right. And we're not talking this American culture, you know, per se. You need some of that too, but your indigenous culture. I think about Dr. Wade Nobles, the psychologist. He has a quote mm-hmm. that I really like. I like Dr. Nobles' quote. He says, "A people's indigenous culture anchors them to reality, and it must be the starting point for all learning. Hence, placing children or centering them within the historical setting is key to fostering educational excellence." Now, as a consultant to several school systems and doing the work you've done, do you agree to that? Is that necessary?
Absolutely. Now, I didn't always believe that. That's something that I've come to over time. But I definitely believe that, and this is not just for Black people. I think this is for all people. When I go into a lot of these organizations and folks are trying to understand social justice and the things that they need to do, and this is a cross race, the first thing that I tell them is that they need to study their indigenous ancestral history.
Right.
That's first. Whether you are European American, African American, Indian, you need to know that history. Because until you understand that, there is no way for you to understand the totality of where we are now, mm-hmm. nor is there a way for you to understand the interactions between different groups and what is going on, the things in which we've told people that they have to hate about themselves or about each other.
Right.
So until we understand our indigenous identities, we can't truly understand what culture is in the first place.
Exactly. Exactly. And you obviously, so you said at one point you didn't agree with that idea. Can you just kind of take us on an evolution up to where you are now? How did that originally happen that you didn't? When was that? What period of your development was it when you didn't agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's probably common to a lot of us. You know, when we go to school, what we're taught is to shed everything of who we are.
Okay.
We have to learn how to put on the mask of the European identity. Well, let me be really specific. The Western European male middle to upper class Eastern,
right.
Northeastern American college educated identity. Mm-hmm. That's what we're taught in schools. And so the first thing that I thought was I had to run away from anything that was African, African-American, Black, anything that I was, I had to shut down and shut up to be successful or valuable in this world.
Mm-hmm.
So my awakening actually came in little pieces and little nuggets over my lifetime. So there were things that happened, like in the sixth grade, where I had a teacher named Mrs. Calico, who she was intuitive enough to see what was happening to me. Miss Calico was from Jackson. Well, she graduated from Jackson State. She's from Rolling Fork, Mississippi.
Okay.
And at that time, she saw me, this straight-A girl who really, really thought she was intelligent but knew nothing about who she was. And Miss Calico decided that she was going to show me who I was. Mm-hmm. And she did that by introducing a test that had, like, the lingo of the hood. And I failed that test. I didn't know how to speak the same lingo as my peers.
Okay.
And we had a conversation about what genius and intellect actually is. It was my first lesson in understanding this kind of brainwashing that happens in our society. But time went on, and when I got to Clark Atlanta, that was when I was introduced to indigenous identity. That was the first time that I was introduced to Black progress and success and freedom. And that was when I felt something spiritually change, psychologically change in me.
Okay.
And when I felt that, that's when I knew. I was like, that is the thing that everybody needs to feel. It was the first time that I actually felt whole and human and free.
Interesting.
But that's not available in public school. So how many of us have that opportunity?
That's interesting, because that's exactly right. My transition was a little bit similar, but it was in a different environmental situation. I was raised in all segregated schools. I was isolated, and that was a good thing, because everybody I knew, everybody around me, all my friends, all my teachers, the librarians, the library, everything was Black. However, it did carry a Negro tone to it. In other words, it wasn't African conscious. We didn't talk about African history. We talked about Negro history. We talked about, at that time, which is what it was called, that's why I'm using the term, we talked about Negro history. We talked about wanting to achieve greatness, you know, and be somebody in this society. But it created a self-confidence. It created a pride, a certain pride, but it was misguided, because obviously it did not carry my indigenous culture. And it was not until I went to New York City and I lived in New York that I really got introduced to my indigenous culture. I remember going down on Lenox Avenue into the Michelle's bookstore and looking at all those Black books. I had never seen anything like that in my entire life. And I remember just sitting in there listening to those guys talk about African kingdoms and African this, which I never had. I never got this. So you're right. I can understand that. And what that leads us to then is that's where we kind of almost break that lock on our minds. Wouldn't you say that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
I completely agree, because I think the thing about being Black, and right now I'm putting that in quotation, and it's not to say that Blackness is not a thing. It is just to say that Blackness is in reaction to whiteness. And that is not our that's not our total identity. Our identity extends beyond this particular experience in this land. And for some of us, I mean, there are people who are Black-skinned who are indigenous to this land.
Right.
But we have a consciousness that has been set around this identity of Blackness, and that's reactionary to European Americans, to whiteness.
Right.
We have to be able to call forth our indigenous identity if we are ever to understand freedom and liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is where we're getting stuck. Well, the reason why we are still having this cycle, we're still seeing lynchings and beatings and killings of Black people, 400, 500, 600, you know, we're still seeing this.
Yes.
And people could ask why, but the reason why is because of that psychological lock that you're talking about. We can't break that lock until we understand the totality of our humanity.
And that
totality does include this indigenous identity that we've been trained to be afraid of.
Right. Now you see why I had to have you on the show today. because that is the absolute truth. You know, you have got, you know, and that's why I called it, the title of the program is Break the Damn Lock, you know, and let's stop playing. You know, we need to do that for our children, and we need to do it for ourselves. Now, as I'm talking, I hope if this thing interrupts, because I'm going to try to play that piece that I just hit. So let me hope that it does play. I think I fixed it, but I think there is a delay in it, which is why I kept trying to do it. But let's see if it does come up. But why it is trying to grab itself? Let me ask this. Now, you were obviously at the prodigious Clark Atlanta, which is was the think tank for W.B. Du Bois and some of his work that he was trying to do, the magazine, the journal called The Phylon, that was a part of his planning, and some of the other things that he wanted to do. Did you see that? Was that something that helped in that stage of development for you?
Yeah, I saw a lot of things. I was really, really blessed to be in the AUC.
Okay.
Because in that center, not only do you have W.E. Du Bois, you got Howard Thurman, you got all of these like brilliant minds, Martin Luther King, all of these brilliant minds that come out of that little center.
Right.
And being a history major, I was a history education major.
Oh, you're a history major.
So it wasn't even just...
Okay.
I just got exposure to it by way of being a student. Like, I studied, you know, our history, African history, African American history, European history, world, like, I got the chance to do
it. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought that was it, but it's not. Go ahead. Keep going. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. It was okay. I was thinking it was about to play. But
yeah, I was hoping it was. I was
just saying, yes.
I really
mean, all of that had a huge impact on my psyche. And today, when people are like, where am I getting these ideas from? I credit all of that to those studies and the continued studies beyond Clark Atlanta. The voices that come through me are a lot of those scholars alongside the ancestors in my own bloodline. But I'm just a vehicle of all of that genius.
Okay. Oh, that's powerful. That's really powerful. Let me ask this. Okay, I think you touched on it a minute ago, and I do agree. What really happened to us to make that lock? How would, as an educator and as someone who is obviously trying to get in to break the locks on the many minds, what is the real thrust of the problem, you know, outside of just slavery? We know what slavery did. We know of its horrendous past and activity. What would you say contributed along with that to the state of being that we are in now? And that might
be... You know, I think about that every day.
Okay.
Honestly... It is my opinion that we forgot that we are divine.
Okay.
We've been convinced out of our skin. We've been convinced that we are bodies and not energies. And so we have absorbed the fears and traumas of other people.
Okay.
Alongside our own. But what I mean by that is, when I was writing this morning about liberation.
Okay.
And in this piece that I was writing, I was talking about, I say Mama Harriet, but Harriet Tubman. I wrote about Harriet Tubman. I wrote about Fred Hampton. I wrote about Kalief Browder, who committed suicide very recently. And I talked about how Harriet Tubman was never a slave in the sense that she always embodied freedom. Her body was enslaved.
Okay.
Her spirit, her energy never was. And subsequently, she found her freedom. She found her liberation because she always had it. When you think about Fred Hampton, he was never murdered If you understand what I'm saying, like, his body was murdered.
Okay.
But we're talking about him today, still.
Okay. That's right.
Because that was a free mind. That was a free man. You understand what I'm saying?
That's exactly
right. I believe the thing that has put us, has gotten us to this point today where we are stuck, is that we have attached ourselves to bodies in the same way that the Western world does. The Western thought is about the individual, about the body, about life. And if you go into indigenous African thought, there is no end. You don't end,
right.
Dr. Rogers. I don't end.
That's right.
Like, there's no such thing. And we started to believe that we end, that there is an end, that we are a body. And that belief set transferred into a fear of what happens to our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing is we also subjected ourselves to the same psychosis of the people who have enslaved us.
Okay.
We believe that we should be, or we are mandated to this state of subjectivity. Subordination. We believe we're supposed to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you have a conversation with a lot of people, the thing that I hear most, and I don't even like to use this term, I talk about white dominance, but I hear a lot of people talk about white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting way to talk about what's going on here. I don't believe in white supremacy. I believe in white fear.
Mm-hmm.
And white fear has manifested into a supreme, extreme attack against whole groups of people.
Yep.
That's not supremacy. That's a terrible level of fear. And we've allowed ourselves to fall victim to that same fear. There are people who fear us. And we internalize that fear and fear ourselves and them as well. We're unwilling to defend ourselves. And then those who do, we call them crazy.
Okay.
So I think we're in a level of psychosis that we've absorbed from other people. And we can only get out of that psychosis by way of what you were talking about, Dr. Rogers, and that is the indigenous study.
Right.
We have to know who we were before this time. Otherwise, we're going to think that what we're seeing right now is normal.
Right. Interesting. Okay, I want to, I think I might have this thing now. Well, no, guess I don't. It's not gonna act right. And see, that's what happens. Sometimes you know when you got something powerful. This is a very powerful interview, and I definitely want to play it. It worked when I was trying it.
Which one was it?
It's an interview that he and Dr. Akbar and Asa Hilliard did on a. It wasn't the Listerfeld, not that, but it was on a Howard University radio station. Two of my research assistants sent it over to me today and told me I should try to play that. And I don't know, maybe it's just a fault on the system that's doing that. Okay, let me ask you this then. All right, so we have this understanding of the intensity of the captivity system that Africans had to endure for over 250-some years because it didn't end in 1865, we know that.
Into
the Jim Crow era, right on up until today. We've been doing this now for over 300 some years. And also some of the things that we've done to ourselves, you know, and our own thought process. So I'm going to play the pessimist here. I'm going to be the Doubting Thomas and ask you, as an educator, with all of that stuff, how in the world do you expect me just doing culture and teaching culture to children and getting them to understand culture will break the chains on their mind, will break that lock? How in the what in the world can possibly, what kind of energy force does that have on children's mind?
It's not even teaching culture. Culture is a tool. what you're teaching a child is how to find themselves.
Uh-huh.
Culture helps you to do that. Our responsibility as an educator is to help the child understand that they are a genius and powerful already. And what we need them to do is stand in that.
Okay.
In our state, understanding our culture in a world that tells us that we are nothing, that we are slaves or that we are subservient to other people, understanding the extent and the breadth of our culture allows us to have access to tools and examples and images by which we can show children and then negate these images that tell them otherwise how powerful they already are.
Okay.
So to answer your question, it's less about teaching culture necessary and more about teaching a child how powerful they already are,
right,
what they already carry, what they already possess. And the culture part comes in to say, and this is how we know. It already existed, and you were just continuing that.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense in terms of doing that. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the program that you're getting ready to operate? First of all, just kind of explain where the idea comes from and the whole concept of a freedom school. Explain that, mm-hmm. and then tell us how do you plan to implement that program.
Sure. So this summer we'll be running a freedom school under the guidance of the Children's Defense Fund. Children's Defense Fund was founded by Marion Wright Edelman in the 1990s,
mm-hmm.
But she built that model from the example of Ella Josephine Baker,
right,
who was an activist during the Civil Rights Movement. And so during the Civil Rights Movement, you had these freedom schools where they were teaching people how to read, something that you mentioned earlier in the show, teaching people how to read so that they could vote. And what has happened now is the Children's Defense Fund, headed by Marion Wright Edelman, they've taken it, that concept, and built like a 6-week reading program. It's a culturally responsive reading program. So children of all ages get to read books that look like them, with people, characters that look like them.
Mm-hmm.
And this program is less about learning how to read and more about learning to love reading.
Right.
And engaging with the community. And the way that the program is structured is you have college students who identify with the students, and they come from the communities that the students come from.
Mm-hmm.
So the college students come back, and they teach a classroom of 10 kids. And there's all kinds of things that are added into this. So we have community members also come in and read a book during the morning Harambe. They do cheers and chants. They have afternoon activities. They go on field trips. We also have, like, parent nights once a week where parents also get their own educational empowerment. And so it's really a community school. It's all of these different folks from the community who are involved and play a part, from college students to elders to city council members to community volunteers. It's just a whole bunch of different people from the community coming together around this concept.
Excellent.
And so that's what we got going on this summer.
Now, is the staff paid? Is it paid staff?
The only staff who are paid are our SLIs, our servant leader interns. That's our college students.
Okay.
They get a small stipend.
Oh, okay.
And then we also give a small stipend to the summer program staff.
Okay.
We have a site coordinator and assistant site coordinator who will get a small stipend as well. So it's not like, you know, racks on racks on racks and I get a whole lot of money.
Okay.
But they do get a stipend for the summer, something small to show appreciation and provide some kind of, you know, sustenance and stability for particularly our college students.
You know why I asked that, right?
Why did you ask?
Because history has shown that when the money comes into play, the commitment goes out the window sometimes. And I know that years ago, I was working in Milwaukee in a program in mentoring. I was working with a good friend who was the director of the mentoring program, Philip Scott. And that was a point we were trying to recruit mentors, and the idea came up whether or not we would pay them. And if it got down to the point of paying the mentors, the commitment to mentor would go out, they felt. And there had been studies done on that. And it was not as reliable as getting just strict volunteer members. You seem to get better commitment when a person volunteers based on their own ideas. And that's why I kind of asked that. Because if you don't have...
Oh, that's interesting. Because I will say, I think I'm mixed on that. So
okay.
I've been working with BOOM for about 2 years.
And tell us what that stands for again.
I've had folks who completely volunteer and they're completely dedicated. I've also had some folks who volunteer and their dedication is not quite there, you know.
Right.
And also as a person who's like first generation high school and first generation college,
mm-hmm.
And comes from, I come from, you know, humble beginnings. I know I wouldn't be able to, like, I wouldn't be able to do anything like this unless there was pay.
Okay.
I couldn't afford to. I worked in high school. I started working at age 14.
Mm-hmm.
I worked several jobs in college. And so I think the circumstances can prohibit, you know, if we did not have a stipend, it could prohibit people who are particularly passionate, you know. Like,
okay.
I've always wanted to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes we can lose out on folks who may be like me, you know, who can't afford to volunteer.
I
literally couldn't afford
And that's true. I do understand that. Yeah, you're right. But it just seems to somehow or the other have a stronger pull when somebody says, I want to do this on my own. I just want to help. And, you know, I'm
mm-hmm.
not looking to get any money, you know. But I guess, you know, you got it both ways, particularly among young people. I think in young people, the stipend definitely is required because you will have to have a kind of a specific kind of setup where you would have to be
mm-hmm.
assured that certain folks will be there every day, you know, so you're right. Let me ask about curriculum. What kind of curriculum are you using?
So the Children's Defense Fund actually has its own curriculum. They have a staff that they pull together to design it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they select different books. And then from those books, they build out like this integrated reading curriculum. And so that includes like activities and conversations, sometimes plays and improv around whatever book it is that we are reading for that day.
Mm-hmm.
So the curriculum is structured by the Children's Defense Fund, and then we go in and add any additional pieces that we deem necessary. But generally, it means to include conversation, an engaging activity, something that's presentation-oriented. So we like to keep it, you know, movement and body involved as well.
Okay. Now, you know, looking at the whole idea, I, when you and I first met, you know, I talked about that all the time, the whole idea that at the time we were calling it Saturday schools, but, you know, it simply
mm-hmm.
means that, and that has a whole nother concept. But it was talking about setting aside a special day outside of the established, you know, educational system to work with your children, regardless of what you do. So I'm sure you couldn't call it you wouldn't be able to call it a Saturday school and draw people because it's going to require parents motivating their children to come and want to come and then,
mm-hmm.
you know, cooperating once they get there. So there's a lot of that has to go into play as well. But one of the things I thought about looking at the whole history of this and how it all even started, you know, because, you know, it actually goes back to... I think the first usage of it in the 20th century was in Mississippi, with the Ella Baker's idea and the Freedom School. That was a guy, his name was Cobb, C-O-B-B, and I cannot think of his first name right now, but his name was Cobb. And he's the one that proposed that. He was a part of SNCC, and he
mm-hmm.
was a strong activist of SNCC, and he was the one that said, let's do it. And put it together, and they were able to pull together an agenda and some folk, and they got behind the Democratic Party, participated in it with it, particularly the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which was a ground root political organization. They got involved, And you're right, they had the whole community tied up, you know, into this whole thing. And so the curriculum for them, as we've indicated, talked about a lot of civics and understanding how the government works and, you know, and why we need to get in and make sure our folks are represented. And they even held a curriculum conference where people got together and talked about how to, you know, make this program work. And one of the keys to it is obviously evaluation. How do you evaluate your success or your failure? So looking at that, how are you all planning to measure whether or not you are reaching young folk, that you are unlocking their minds? What is it that you want to see happen after the school, after the program is operated?
Well, Children's Defense Fund has its own surveys and that kind of thing, but what we want to do is we're working with the school where we're hosting. So we're hosting the site at Jay and Irvin Elementary School here in Dallas.
Right.
And working with the administrators there to assess, okay, where are our students starting at the summer, you know, mm-hmm. when we start? And then coming back on the other end of this, at the end of the summer, and saying, like, okay, where are they ending up? Because what we want to see is during the school year, what kind of performance do we see? Do we see any difference between the Freedom School kids and mm-hmm. the kids who did not do Freedom School? And what can that tell us about this approach? So we want to try to work with the school to understand, like, what their tools say.
Okay.
Not that I should name that I'm not always a fan of our school systems assessment metrics. I'm not always a fan, but I understand that schools generally use those. And so because they have to use those, it would be important for us, if we're going to support students in that system, to yeah. understand where they are within those metrics.
Yeah, and you know, it's clearly a very devastating thing, is this whole standardized test, because what mm-hmm. ends up happening is people end up working with kids to help them pass the standardized tests. You know,
mm-hmm,
and that to
mm-hmm.
me is a serious, serious problem. I don't know if you remember, probably a little bit before your time, but Dr. Hilliard, Asa Hilliard, he did a study. Now, you might have studied about it in your work. He did a study on, I think it was in California, about the alternatives to IQ testing. And looking at the whole standardized test movement. And Hilliard had some very interesting things. As you know, he was a psychologist, and he recognized mm-hmm. that these things did not test African children to be able to determine anything. And so, you know, so he worried about things like the cultural biases in the testing and the use of this whole diplomatic way of the, I think at that time it was an organization called the American Board of Forensic Examiners. And they were looking at stuff medically in terms of how the brain works. And then eventually what would come out is all these studies, you know, and you know the big infamous bell curve that came about mm-hmm. looking at how black children
yep.
study. Well, Hilliard, and all of that, even the bell curve was considered based on some standardized test stuff. And he really wanted to get rid of that and take that out of that. And I think that's one of the reasons, as you know, I don't know, have you ever looked at the African-American Portland baseline study?
You ever looked at it? I haven't. Tell me more about that.
Okay, it's called the African-American Portland baseline studies. And it was attacked vehemently by mainline education. And what Dr. Hilliard was doing, and this was back in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, and this baseline study was an attempt to implement African studies, philosophy, mathematics, science, and all of that from an African perspective into the curriculums. He was doing it, I think he did it in Portland, well, obviously Portland because it's called the Portland Baseline Studies. I think also Atlanta, and maybe Detroit and New York, they were offered these. And what they were doing was teaching stuff about Egypt, ancient Kemet, looking at the birthplace of philosophy, mathematics, and all of those kinds of things, and looking at a lot of how West African culture has to be understood. And it was an attempt to put this, infuse this into the school system. And obviously they went to work on it and attacked it and saying it was pseudo-history, pseudo-science, and that it really was not correct, and, you know, just a lot of back and forward kinds of things. But that was his attempt to get this in. That was his to get this in so that we can begin to look at a different framework for measuring academically our children. So I guess the question I wanted to ask in doing that, somehow or the other, how do you see bringing that, because you can't get rid of the standardized test right now.
Right.
But
right.
How do you fuse that together to make it so that the cultural awakening can also play into this standardized stuff? How do we do that? Because I think we got to work with that too.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I'm hoping is that, very similar to when I was still in the classroom, we have to have performance-based assessments as well. And performance-based allows us to see how the student has internalized the information and can create something new
right.
from their own identity, mindset, knowledge set, you know, skill set.
Right.
And so on top of, like, surveys and traditional, and I'm putting traditional in quote marks right now, traditional assessments, we also have, the reason why we also have, like, the parent nights and that kind of thing, we have a finale night where students are taking everything that they learned and they're creating products that they showcase to their parents and to the community. So that way we can make sure that it's transferring into something meaningful
okay.
for them. Something that I think the most important assessment that we can do regardless of age, and this never stops if you're in school or not, is creation. And that's from 10 to 110.
Okay.
What can you create from what you have learned?
Okay, excellent.
And that is the assessment that I'm hoping to implement as well beyond any kind of survey or pencil paper kind of test.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I like what you said about the field trips, because that has a way of working as well.
Mm-hmm.
You can able to take them and show them things, let them see how stuff worked. I remember taking a group of middle school young people to the home of Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi and to show them where she lived and what she had to endure as a field sharecropper. But at the same time, she had this political zeal that she wouldn't let anything stop her. She had a sixth grade education in terms of public school, but she was a brilliant woman. And so they got a better understanding of that by being there, walking through her memorial and putting their hands on her headstone and understanding the spiritual power of that and letting it inundate them. And so I think those kinds of cultural awakenings, you're right, that do help and do that. Now, when does your program begin?
So we start on June 18th, and we run all the way through August 3rd.
Okay. Oh, great. Okay, that's wonderful. And that's now, how does a student have an opportunity to participate? What do they have to do? Do they sign up?
Well, this year, the priority seats go to the school. So since we're housing it at an elementary school,
okay,
and we have seats for an elementary school, the priority seats go to the kids who are at that elementary school. And then we have 10 seats that are available to students outside of that elementary school.
Okay, now, did the school system, since you're having it in an elementary school, did they sign off on this? Did they? How did they look at it when
yes.
you presented it to them?
Yeah, so we had to have a contract with Dallas ISD to have it at the school, so they signed off on us being able to be at Jay and Irving.
Okay, all right. Now, very clearly, when we come back, I'm going to take a quick break in just a minute. When we come back, we're going to open up the lines to our callers. We have a few callers online, and let them ask any questions. But when we come back, I want to talk specifically about how someone would put a system like that in place. what would they do? What are the steps for opening a freedom school or something of that nature? And how do you see someone beginning to do that? How possible is that to do it? Mm-hmm. Like, say, even beginning next month, you know, what needs to happen, you know, in order to do that? So I want to kind of look a little bit specifically at, you know, how that might operate. And then, you know, just kind of, begin that whole idea of this as a solution. I mean, is this a viable solution? I really want to ask that question. Is this a viable solution to unlock our mind? So we need to make sure we do that. So let's take a quick break, and we come back.
Who taught you, please? Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate, you should ask who taught you to hate being what God gave you.
I thought that was appropriate. To look at that, there will be critics, obviously, and not that we care, but I just want to look at how do you respond that says that, well, you know, in having young people come to the Freedom School, is it open to all ethnicities or is it cultural specific?
Well, our school is open to all ethnicities. However, it is placed in an area where it's predominantly Black, and there's some Latino students there too.
Okay.
But it's predominantly Black area, so it's largely predominantly, you know, the students will be predominantly Black.
Okay. I would think that, and I'm going to be real here, I'm going to think that it would need to be strictly that. I couldn't see opening that up outside of the culture for a lot of different reasons, unless, for instance, the parent, sometimes you can't help people are in a certain area, and I do guess you do open yourself up for a lawsuit, but that's why I like the volunteer part, where everything is voluntary. There's no money involved. Mm-hmm. It's like you and I have a party, and so a guy lives down the street, hears that I'm having the party, and he comes over, can I come in? No, you can't. This is a private party. And I can do that mm-hmm. because it's private. You know, I'm not looking at, but when you're looking at government funds and you're doing some other things and he knocks on the door, I might have to consider something differently. So that's mm-hmm. one of the mm-hmm. Areas that I think is very clear to opening this type of institution in the community. It needs to be cultural specific. And so therefore, that's why the money has to stay out of it in a certain kind of way.
Yep.
Because if not, then you can be guilty of discriminating and be sued, actually, in terms of discriminating. Did you all discuss that as well?
And therein becomes the catch-22, right? Because it depends on, it takes a certain level of privilege to be able to do that, right? Like, you have to have a certain level of access to be able to, like, have the time and freedom to do something voluntarily.
Right.
Again, this is where, like, I remember when I went to Clark Atlanta, I had a huge awakening about what class background I came from,
right.
You know? There were things that other people were able to do that I just wasn't able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come back, you grow up, and you come back into your community, that just perpetuates itself.
Okay.
The reason why you have a lot of, and I'm going to call out white people who go into communities doing all of this service work, and I'm putting service in quotations right now, mm-hmm. is because a lot of folks have more access and more privilege to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to that question about, like, the question you said you want to ask coming soon, how do we do this? One of the big questions that we got to start asking is, like, who are the people in our communities who have that type of access and privilege, who can afford to pour in that way? And will they do it? Because that's the second part.
That's the second part, right?
The big challenge that I found is, like, the people who really want to give time and dedication don't always have the time. They have to go to work. They have to be paid. So there's an extent, you know, there's a stopping point.
Okay.
The people who do have the time and the resources may not always want to spend their time and resources in this way. And I think that's a deeper question for us to explore in our community, because I think we haven't really explored what it means when we do have means, because it's not all Black people ain't poor.
We got
a lot of Black people with money and resources and time, but that may not want to do it this way, contribute in this way, and what is that about?
Okay. That's a good point, because I think that definitely, so that kind of tells me that there's some prep work that goes into having to set up a system, a school like this, that you need to do some kind of a survey or door-to-door kind of thing with your with the community and tell them what we're trying to do and see what kind of response you get, you know, and then, you know, call them out on it. You know, I think it's got to be an aggressive process. There's a story I remember. And in preparation for today's program, I did look up a little something. There was a guy out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His name was John Churchville. This was a well-known kind of story, but John Churchville wanted to start a Freedom School type of situation. This was during the Black Power Movement, 1964. I think he was an educator himself. And he wanted to do it, but he wanted to set up some hardcore policies. He wanted to do it around a revolutionary nationalist movement kind of thing, which, you know, at that time is going to draw some heat. And he wanted to kind of do it like your one of your mentors, Dr. Fuller, wanted to do when he started the Malcolm X University in Durham, North Carolina. And he wanted to get that perspective into it. And so he believed, for instance, that if education is the indoctrination of the young into an ideological system, he said, then the Freedom School must re-educate Black children to reject the dominant ideology and construct a new system. That was his philosophy about this. This is John Churchville out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I've got some callers that are on now from Philadelphia who are also educators. They might be able to tell us a little bit more about John Churchville. And he had a curriculum that was very radical in its perspective. It was designed to explain the eugenic situation of Black people, and it had to teach tools and skills to deal with this reality. So it was not just talk. They were talking about tools, and the curriculum was described by Churchville as a vehicle for teaching revolutionary truth, he said. The content was mostly irrelevant, as if it was the analysis which would demonstrate the reality. And so eventually, which is expected, the school was raided by the FBI in 1966 on suspicion of harboring militant groups. And so somebody in the community probably sold them out. And they came in and did some things. And there have been other freedom schools around the country. There's Chicago, had the Black Panther Party used to do something similar to that. Michigan, they had an organization in Michigan called the Black Radical Congress. And they were there putting together freedom schools. And so, you know, you've got some models that were done. Are you familiar with the curriculum done by Jawanza Kanjufu called Set Clay?
I've heard of this, but I haven't seen it.
It actually is Set Clay. It's just SETCLAE. That's the acronym. It stands for Self-Esteem Through Culture Leads to Academic Excellence. Self-esteem through culture leads to academic excellence. And a lot of the African immersion school programs in public schools operated on the Set Clay curriculum. I looked on their website, and in their promotion to sell their curriculum, they said that the curriculum was going to do 7 things: promote self-esteem, it would improve academic achievement, it would reduce disciplinary problems, it is easily integrated into the curriculum, it was of high quality, inexpensive material and support service. At in-service training, they would give with anyone that would purchase a set play model, and it encouraged parental involvement. Now, that's the other question, then I'm going to go to our audience. What about parents? How do they get involved in your Freedom School idea?
Well, parents are a key part of our Freedom School. So one of the requirements, actually, for a child to be in our Freedom School is that the parent has to commit to coming to empowerment nights once a week. There are other roles that parents can play, of course, throughout the Freedom School. But we wanted to make sure that this was a holistic family engaging process. So it's not just the child who comes to Freedom School. Okay. Parent has to be a part, like has to. They sign in the child, sign out the child. They come on field trips on Fridays with us. But the big thing is that they are required, like it's a requirement that parents engage in our empowerment nights once a week. And empowerment nights can be anything from financial literacy to even just a celebration of parenthood and what that can look like. How do you have healthy communication in the home? So parent empowerment nights are a large part of how this Freedom School is going to work.
Okay. All right, I'm going to open up. I'm going to go to my good brother from Philadelphia, area code 267-333. I want to start off by asking him, had he heard of John Churchville before? Is that a name that's familiar to him in the Philadelphia area? Good afternoon, my brother. How you doing?
Brother Timothy.
Yes, sir. How you doing today?
Is this Dr. Robinson?
Yeah, this is Dr. Robinson. Yes. How you doing?
Yes, how are you, sir?
Good.
Yes, ma'am, I'm impressed with you. What is your last name, ma'am?
My last name is Jenkins.
Jenkins. What's your first name, Ms. Jenkins?
Jamie.
Okay, Jamie, listen to me. We have a very interesting and similar background. I am a graduate from Lincoln University, and how I got connected into the culture very young at 16, 17, and 15 years of age is that in the late 60s, early 70s, Philadelphia was known as a Muslim town, a black Muslim town, a nationalist town. It was also known for Marcus Garvey's, one of his headquarters here. And the Black Power movement with Cecil B. Moore and a church by the name of the Church of Advocate, Dr. Paul Washington. He was known to have those Black Power rallies and movements. Let me get to my point. So I was influenced by a lot of my friends as a gang member at that time, as a teenager. After that time, as time went on, gang war faded out, and people were really getting immersed in movement. But the people who taught me more about Black history and culture came from out of incarceration. This is the truth. At 18 years of age, I learned so much from my friends who read the Muhammad Speak. They read the books on the Black Panther card. They read the Malcolm X autobiography back and forth. So by the time I get to Lincoln University, the good thing about Lincoln University is it was always this stuff about Cheney University too. Howard Morgan also, about how much Black history are you learning? Now, this is 1979, 1980, and 1981. And people were hungry for Man, Child, and the Promised Land. Did you read Baldwin's book? You know of Langston Hughes. So the good thing about Lincoln is the professors would have you do a book on George Orwell, 1984, but he also asked you, what do you want to do one on? Okay. And they were white and black. Because Lincoln would do black things. Now, listen to me. I learned something from you two people. Our university is so historical that we have dorms named after Lorraine Hansberry, Lucy Laney, Okay. And you know what? Mm. When you said Lucy Laney, uh-huh. I never knew that Lucy Laney Hall is about the woman you was talking about.
Okay.
Mm. Now listen, that is so important. And because we had a president about 5 years ago, and we ran him out of there. His name was Jenkins, Dr. Jenkins. And he wanted to remove some of the buildings off of the university that were historical. He also wanted to change our graduating date. Lincoln University's graduates always the first Sunday in the month in May, because it's the first Sunday in May because we have it that way, because Mother's Day is the second Sunday in May. We want the mothers, the aunts, the uncles, the grandfathers, and all the family to be on the lawn. Well, we were able to remove him with, I'm a class of 83, Lincoln University. I have a 35-year reunion. And there was a young lady. I was on a court. She's an OKA. Her name is Dr. Brenda Allen. I'm a Kappa. And she was on our court before I became a Kappa. But my point is that she is now the president. Dr. Brenda Allen is now the president of Lincoln University. Do you know where that put us in?
Okay.
She's from us. Mm-hmm. She welcomes us. She's with us at homecomings. She's with us at graduation. And this environment of Afrocentricity, you're able to cultivate your mind and your culture in our environment.
That's right.
But I'm going to tell you this. As a public school teacher, who my graduate work is in English education with a concentration on the Harlem Renaissance. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, in studying English, you have history. But I teach English education with a focus of the Harlem Renaissance, Afro-American studies, world history, and civics. Now, listen to me. And this is very important, and I'm going to tell you. I'm able to be very fortunate with the presence I've had that when I do African-American history, I start with Orlando Aquiano. From Orlando Aquiano, I go from David Walker's appeal. I'm able to incorporate in their curriculum, which is watered down with what I've been taught, to give them what I know, and they're fascinated with it. Now, I have my good, bad, and ugly with my students. They're like anything else. They're not perfect. They're home life. Mm-hmm. They're not always connected with their parents. Education starts at home. But the ones that I can reach, I try my best to let them know Douglas. They know Phyllis Wheatley. They know Jupiter Hammond. And they learn how to read and write, and that's important. Before you came on, Dr. Robinson, and I told them I used to have a course called Teen Court, where they learn about the judge, the magistrate, the side of the defense, the side of the prosecution. That's right. A story within itself. That's another time.
That's good.
But
that's
getting
good.
Back to it, unfortunately, this program has collapsed. I'm going to tell you about it. Mm-hmm. There was two very concerned teachers came from two high schools. Their name is the Bivens, okay? Mm-hmm. And the Bivens, on the summertime, had a summer school, and the name of the summer school was called the Black Caucus Summer School. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they called it the Black Caucus Summer School, and the people who they worked with, a guy by the name of John Steve, unfortunately, he's dead, is that they were connected to the legislator. I was a black guy by the name of Dave Richardson. Anybody tell you about Dave Richardson from Philadelphia? When he comes to meet, he has his dashiki and his black power pin and fist around his neck.
What's his name?
Again? At that point, Dave Richardson, through the Bivens, was able to get state funding for the summer school, the Black College Summer School. So we're able to incorporate the culture and all that is needed to cultivate our children's minds. So I'm thinking that it's always good to have with you someone who's connected to politics, because the problem with the Philadelphia school system is it doesn't get enough money from the state. But it's a state issue. The public school system in Philadelphia is a state issue.
Okay.
So if you could get some type of politician who's connected and sees your dream, then that helps you. Another thing, was John Steve involved with the Black Caucus Summer School? A guy by the name of Dr. Ed Robinson. Are you familiar with Dr. Ed Robinson?
No.
Dr. Robinson?
No, I haven't. Huh? No.
Okay, he wrote a book called The Journey of the Songhai People.
What's the name of the book?
Journey of the Songhai People.
Okay.
Right. But my point is that you keep on going with what you're doing, and now the Bivens are now retired, and they need the people who have worked with them in the past, they're trying to rebuild that summer school. Now, there's also a guy in Philadelphia named Dr. Tony Montel. He does the Saturday schools at this place called the Church of the Advocate. So Philadelphia's doing some interesting things. Could it be better? We're trying. Do we have forces to do this? Yes, we do. But I'm telling you, you got to keep on with it, though, because our children need us.
Okay.
They need us.
That's true. Let me ask you, but have you heard of John Churchville?
I never heard of him.
Okay.
I never, but I will look him up because Dr. Rogers, everybody you told me about, and you told me to look him up, it was always true. So he's somebody I probably need to know about.
Well, I try to stay in the truth, but this brother was, he was powerful. He had this, it was called the Freedom, it was called the Philadelphia Library Day School. And it was very radical. It was about 65, 66, somewhere in there. And then eventually the FBI raided the school and accused him of harboring criminals. But interesting. That's an interesting thing.
The Philadelphia Library, what?
Oh, it was called the Freedom Library Day School.
Freedom, okay.
Library Day School. That's what it was called. And it was the same kind of format that we're talking about, but very clearly it was, he was radical. He said that you got to look at something totally different. And it was my understanding that he came through the, he was one of the key people at the Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana, when they made that decision to look at doing independent schools and building independent schools.
That's very good. And, you know, Gary, Indiana was known to be very black at one time. The Jackson was from there. In fact, I think they had the first black mayor in the country.
Yeah, Richard Hatcher. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. So I'm going to be looking at it. If anybody from Philadelphia tell you about John Skeefe, and John Skeefe and the Bivens started together.
Okay.
And John Skeefe had one of the first charter schools in Philadelphia. Now, mm-hmm. listen to this now.
Right.
I have my issues with charter schools, but his charter school was completely different.
Right.
He was not into the money aspect. Oh, I'm the CEO, and it's a business, and this is not like a freedom thing or education. No, he didn't run his like that.
Right.
But unfortunately, he died. Now it's different. It's in other hands now.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people in Philadelphia were on that level. The Bivens were one of them, and so was John Skeefe. And they had backing, like, people from Dr. Ed Robinson, who wrote The Journey of the Sunline People, and they were politically connected with a state legislator named Dave P. Richardson.
Right.
And he made sure they got the funding that they needed because he knew that the public school system in Philadelphia, if you were not connected politically, your children were going to get a watered-down education. It's that way now. Right. Only certain schools in Philadelphia that are public have the best of the education. And sometimes, most of the time, our people can't get in them.
Okay.
They're predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
But our children are in some of them. But a lot of us need to be in them more. And depending upon their grades, they're awarded the testing. The testing, that's the game. They don't make AYP. It becomes political.
Okay.
Matter of fact, they close and tear down schools and put condos in the place of them. Philadelphia is suffering with racism.
Yeah.
And Uncle Tom's.
I agree.
See, wherever you see a white man, you can always find an Uncle Tom.
Oh, yeah. No doubt about it. Mr. Shea, let me ask you in terms of the your program and what you're doing, your school program, in terms of how you're going to work. Is this on the weekend, or how's it going to go during the week? Because school is out, obviously, in June. Are you going to do it during the week, or are you going to do it just the weekends? How is it going to be done? Mr. Shea?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking. Can you ask the question again?
Yeah, I was asking, how is it going to be done? Are you going to do it weekdays? You going to go to 5 days a week, 2 or 3 days a week?
It's weekdays. So it's 6 weeks, Monday through Friday.
Monday through Friday. Okay. I've got another caller on that I'm going to bring on. He's from Milwaukee. He's been involved in youth programs, and he was a part of the Opportunity Industrials community, OIC, better known as OIC, and he ran a program working with young boys, So hopefully he can come on and tell us a few things. Any questions you have, Mr. Scott?
No, Dr. Rogers, I'm really enjoying the program, but I want to say that what you did, I mean, the program, it was two things I'd like to say is you made a very valid point in reference to when the money comes in, a lot of the compassion leaves out for a lot of the people who want to be involved and truly use their compassion to really work for you. And I remember we went after that grant for $80,000 to keep the program going.
Right.
And we were before the Governor's Commission on Juvenile Justice. And everybody there was saying, how can we afford, how can we compete against paid mentors? And so this other gentleman spoke, and you spoke, and then a part just came in while I spoke. And I mean, we hit that panel so hard. I mean, they just couldn't understand. But the bottom line, when it was all said and done, we got the grant.
Okay. And right. That's right.
You know, the other part is, and the young lady, what she says, she would have to be paid. That's truly understood. Administrative processes. You know, people do have to make a living to make these type of programs work. But we did so many phenomenal things to satisfy the mentors. To keep them, to make them whole, and to keep them involved. But you did something that was very, very unique. And nobody never really understood it, never really looked at it. But you actually instituted Saturday School when you created the six module curriculum for the training.
Right.
So they had to complete six modules to be certified to mentor in the program.
Right.
And if they missed a Saturday, then there was another Saturday that they could come and make that Saturday up. So 12 weeks, 12 Saturdays out of the year, 12 Saturdays, we had those rooms full of men coming in from 9 o'clock in the morning to 12 to 1 o'clock in the afternoon, taking that curriculum to be certified to be mentors in this program. Now we followed the curriculum and we taught out. We talked about mentoring. We did the whole nine, but
right.
we got off some sociological things, some psychological things, and surely we got off into a lot of historical things, but. I really have to tip my hat to you and how you uniquely put together a Saturday school without people really recognizing and even knowing that that's what you were doing with the six-module curriculum.
Right, thank you.
In that mentoring program.
That's exactly what I was doing. That's exactly what I was doing.
And to this day, nobody really, really recognized it and knew it. If we had said that, Dr.
Yeah.
Rogers is doing a Saturday school, you know, it would have been a lot of hoopla.
Oh, they'd have ran like crazy.
But
right.
It was very successful. And those men, they came faithfully. And they all graduated. We didn't have a lot of turnover. And we didn't have a lot of men who didn't want to participate. You know, it was just a great time.
Well, I appreciate
lady,
you because
I want to say that you are tenacious, vivacious, and I mean you are the future, and you just keep doing what you're doing, and keep listening to the rank and file, and I say let the rank and file support her as we should, because that was the problem that I can say I had is a lot of the rank and file, the old cadres trying to hold on. And not trying to pass that baton.
Right.
You cannot hold on. You got to pass it on to the young ones and let them do what they need to do. At some point in time, we become the senior advisory council. And as long as you keep listening, young lady, you're going to be successful. And as long as we keep giving the information needed so that you can be successful, everything is going to work out. And so you have all of my blessings.
Great.
You have all of my blessings. And you picked a great host for tonight, Dr. Rogers.
Okay.
Thank you so much for
Thank
having
you.
Me for this few minutes.
Thank you for your comments. Thank you so much. Mr. Shea, I wanted to mention this too. At one point in Milwaukee, we got together, Mr. Scott said, we recognized that obviously if you were going to do something like a Saturday school or Freedom School, and that's why that last question I asked you was so critical about the parental involvement, because the parents have to be involved in that. And, you know, obviously you have structured a platform to get the parents engaged, you know, in this program. But one of the things, we kind of took a step further and went ahead once and created a community versity.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Marcus Garvey Community Versity. And what it was is that we brought parents together at night and taught Black history classes. And they knew what they were taking. We offered the courses. We had classes on the life and times of Booker T. Washington. We had the life and times of Marcus Garvey. We taught the introduction to African-American history. And we used community people. We used a lot of the brothers and sisters who were part of the ASCAC organization, Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization. We used them and had them to come in and to teach a lot of those classes to the parents. And that way we encouraged the parents to take these lessons back to their children and teach them about their mm-hmm. history and culture and greater interests. And we were doing it in a seminary. We used the building of a seminary called Milwaukee Theological Institute, which was a school to train pastors. And it was going well. And then some of the board members of the school, Black preachers, said, well, are these people Christians? You know, I said, well, what difference does that make? You know, we just want to do the work. You know, well, if they're not Christians, I'm opposed to this. So as a result, we had to stop, because I'm not about to ask anybody what their religion was, because that wasn't the purpose of it. So we ended up stopping. But mm-hmm. do you think something like that also could work? Maybe even if you couldn't do the Saturday school for the children, you could at least do something for the parents who, and obviously it was all voluntary. I mean, we weren't making them. And, you know, we told them what we were doing, and they came. We would get 20, 30 students a night that would come take these classes. What do you think?
No, I think that's absolutely possible. We actually have another one of my big sisters here in the community, Dr. Safisha Hill, who is a professor at University of Arlington, University of Texas at Arlington,
okay.
UTA. She runs a community organization called the Act of Change, and on Monday night, she actually does that, where she teaches, or she brings in other people as well to teach Black in African history to the community for free. People can do donations if they want to, but it's open. And so one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is how to make it practical for your everyday parents. So sister has my nephew, and something that we noticed was I was able to give her practical ideas of things to do day to day to work with him. And so she was saying a way that we could take it a step further is by providing, like, curricular tools for parents that they can think about the ways in which what they do every day could be lessons and valuable teachable moments for them, between them and their child.
Okay. So
I absolutely believe in that model. We have it going, and so I just want to figure out the ways in which I can support, because I think another challenge that we find in our community is that everybody is trying to do the same thing, and what we need to see more of is a collaborative, coordinated effort so that we can get maximum impact.
Okay, I see. let me just real quickly, you are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. This is we're here every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m., 8 to 10 p.m. here on TimeForAwakening.com. We're also on Blog Talk Radio on Saturdays from 4 to 6. And we thank all of you, our listening audience, for your support. Our discussions are very similar to the one that you're hearing tonight. I'm here talking with my good friend from Dallas, Texas, Ms. Jamie Lachey, and we are talking about the implementation and organizing of the possibility of Freedom Schools, what we call Freedom Schools. The Black Reality Think Tank is a part of the TimeForAwakening.com radio network, which is also a part of the BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. There are several programs that are on this system. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we have the program African Perspectives, which is hosted by Brother Oshiemi Adelabu. It airs every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And then on Monday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., there's a program called Acres of Diamonds, Acres of Diamonds, Monday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And by the way, any of these programs you can preview by going to the TimeForAwakening.com website and playing some of the archived programs to get an idea of the type of information and discussions that's carried forth. And then, obviously, on Tuesday from 8 to 10, we have the Black Reality Think Tank, and I'm your host, Dr. William Rogers. And then on Wednesday, from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., we have a program called Revive. Revive, and it's hosted by POC, which means Proof of Consciousness, Proof of Consciousness. And then on Friday, from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m., Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. A wonderful conversation. We've had some follow-through kinds of conversations from what we talked about, and then we would go over to Brother Elliot's program with Brother Richard, and we would talk even further and explore those ideas very differently. We work together as a community. So each of us have our own shows with its own identification, but we all work together into pushing these ideas that will help in the development of our community. I have been on Brother Oshie's program. He's been on mine several times, and we want to keep that format. And then on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., we have Sports Talk with host Troy Wilmore. Sport Talk, host is Troy Wilmore. And then on Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Proof of Consciousness, POC, with the program called Revive. Revive. And then Brother Elliot is on again on Sunday evening from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., with Time for an Awakening. And if you desire to listen, you can just simply go for timeforanawakening.com, or you can call our studio line, which is area code 215-490-9832, 215-490-9832. Okay, Sister Jamie, in the time that we've got left, I come to you as a consultant. And I say to you, Mr. Shea, I want to start a community-type school, a freedom school. I don't want it to be a part of the educational system. I just want to teach some things to my children. What are the steps that I should take? What's the first thing I need to do?
I think the first thing is to have a meeting with your community.
Okay.
I think it's critical that before trying to start an institution, you know that you have the support, the blessing, the backing. Because I think sometimes we can lead with our convictions and not necessarily lead with community needs. So I think step one is having, the meetings with the community to understand, like, do you have the support of the community? Will you have the people there to work with you? Beyond that, I think the next big piece is determining how you are going to, like, structure this program. It so happens that we are doing a program that already has its own curriculum, and we had to raise money so that we can give stipends to our college students and that kind of thing, but that's not always necessary. We've done programs without paying people. And if you're going to do that, a lot of times you have to determine when can this happen? What's the most optimal time for most people? Where can you get a location for free? So securing your location.
Okay.
But the big piece for me is like determining what impact you are hoping to have. What is the ultimate outcome, and what kind of work is necessary to achieve that outcome?
Very good.
So, for example, if the ultimate outcome is we really want to see activism in our children, what kind of curriculum do you need to build to ensure that that activism is true? And or can you find other organizations that have already done something like this that you can learn from, borrow from, and build from? I would recommend in the first year finding tools and resources that already exist and testing those out, and then using that as a testing ground to figure out what you want to be true for your school in that next year.
And, you know, hearing you say that is so critical that you do that up front. What is it that I want to have accomplished? What is the model when this program ends and we go back to our other way? What is it that I want to see in the young people that I have worked with? You know, and that's critical. And then obviously, like you said, looking at those resources, one of the best resources in our community, I don't care what anybody says, I don't care who owns it or what it does, but is the public library. That is very clearly an excellent resource. I used to take our Saturday kids, the program that I used to run with Mr. Scott, I would take the kids up to the public library and we would do puppet shows. And I would have them do puppet shows where they have a chance to create some of the things that we talked about, because the library had a little puppet theater. And you could go in and use the puppets and talk, you know, and do all kind of different things. And so I had our kids go in and do a puppet show on what we talked about. And it was excellent, excellent idea. So you're right to do that. So let me continue in that light of as I said before, the Doubting Thomas, the pessimist. So I'm talking to you now as that person, the pessimist, the Doubting Thomas. Now, are you really sure this is going to work? I mean, come on now. You trying to tell me if I do all this, I'm going to break the chains on the minds of people? How would you answer me?
Well, I would answer honestly. I'm sure of nothing. I'm sure of nothing in this lifetime. What I'm sure of is that I am going to do whatever I have to do to try. I'm unwilling to like just sit back and ponder and do the what if. And so I just encourage us as a people to get to a place where if you see a problem and you got a criticism and you got a perspective about it, do something. You know, I think, and I was having a conversation with Dr. Fuller actually about this recently. I think right now we are in a state of critical thought about a lot of things.
Okay.
I just don't want us to get stuck in critical thought. So I would answer that I'm not sure of anything. The only thing I can be sure of is my action. And so I would encourage anybody who has criticism or questions to test it out. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you got something better. The point is, get out there and do something.
All right. All right. Exactly. I love it. I love it. And so, you know, with that, I think we still have our work cut out for us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. And I definitely think that you're going to make some headway. I really do, based on fact number one, knowing you and knowing the energy that which you have and the love you have for your people and your community. That's going to be a number one. You got that Murray McLeod Bethune, Lucy Craft Laney spirit. I hear it all the time. And when we talk about that, you have real passion when it comes to dealing with your kids. So number one, that, and then obviously you got a plan, and you're going to put that plan in action. So you're not just going at it off from the hip. You know, you got some logistics that you want to achieve, and you got some goals and objectives that you want to have met. And so I think with that, you can do it. So to our audience, I want to say, you know, this can be done. It does not require a lot. Now, Jamie, you want to give out your website. You have an organization called BOOM. What does BOOM stand for?
Mm-hmm. Building Opportunities and Opening Minds. The website is www.weboom.org. So that'd be W as in William three times, W as in William, E as in Eric, B as in Boston, O as an Oscar, O as an Oscar, M as in Marvin, .org. That's our website.
All right. And can they also email you there and, you know, email you as well? And is there an email connection there for them? For anybody
sure.
That might want to talk with you?
Can email me directly at Jamie, and that's J-A-M-I-E, the at symbol, weboom.org.
Say that once more.
Jamie at weboom.org.
Okay.
J-A-M-I-E, the at symbol, W-E-B-O-O-M.org.
And so to our audience, you know, as I've indicated to you, all of our programs are archived. So you can always go back into the archive on the timeforanawakening.com website, www.timeforanawakening.com website. And this particular broadcast will be up probably in about 4 or 5 days, and you'll be able to go back and play and pick up any information that you want. But if you have any interest, if any of our listeners have any interest in looking at doing this, because I do think that it is a step. You know, as being an educator myself and having taught in the university for many years, I do believe that there is some work that can be done through culture to break the chains of the African mind. And so with that, Ms. Lachey, thank you so much. I appreciate you all the time. You know I'm going to call on you again now, so you don't think that this is, you know.
Well, you're always welcome to. I always enjoy it.
Okay, great. I always enjoy you. And to our audience, thank you for listening. We'll be back here again next Tuesday evening at 8 p.m., 8 to 10, right here at timeforanawakening.com. Also, you can listen to us on Blog Talk Radio, www.blogtalkradio.com. Simply put in Sankofa Historical Society. Live, Sankofa Historical Society Live, and they will pick up the live program on Saturday evening at 4 o'clock. We thank you, have a wonderful and blessed week, and I'll see you
black
next
week. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us. Black.